Welcome to Season 9, Episode 14 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we choose to talk about cyberpunk games, as promised. We also flirt with adventurers in the desert. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 14 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me is Chris and Paul. And Paul is back from a hiatus, so welcome back, Paul.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be back.
Good to see you again. Or hear you anyway.
Yeah. It's always a pleasure. I love having more than me and somebody else.
That's good to have a round table.
That's one of the things I've always said, told people about this podcast, that I loved about doing this podcast with other people is, by myself, I'm not a very interesting person on a podcast. Although, yep. I have done one episode that didn't turn out too bad. But that's the exception rather than the rule. So why don't we hit the news? Because, God, there's a big one, which is freaking Gen Con, selling out of four-day passes already. And they're predicting to sell out of the other passes as well. There will be no will call window. How crazy is that?
That's truly insane and truly monstrous.
Yeah.
Like you were saying before, it's literally showing how big Gen Con has become.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't, you know, I've said this and I don't know. I think Gen Con's gotten too big. But, and I don't think, I don't know where you could actually put it. I think it's just reached the point where it's ridiculous. And I don't know where this size really comes from, because it's not the RPG market, really.
Right.
You know.
Well, and I'm actually seeing this with a lot of conventions. They're outgrowing their venues, and they're expanding their dates. They're running out of passes. And what it honestly looks like to me is a bubble, and that in the next couple of years, we're going to see this convention bubble kind of burst. And I hope it doesn't hurt anybody too bad, but I am seeing, you know, this isn't you know, just Gen Con or anything like that. I'm seeing this happen with a lot of different conventions all over the country.
Yeah, well, I know that, like, locally in Phoenix, we have the Phoenix Comic Con, which has become slightly infamous lately. But that one, you know, again, that convention obviously is a comic convention rather than a role-playing game convention, although I think there are some RPG games that actually go on there. I've never gone because while I like comics, I'm not interested in the Comic-Con, and while cosplay is interesting, I'm not a major cosplayer or someone who's really interested in cosplay. And especially at Phoenix Comic-Con, that's probably, I hate to say
not
it.
Not even if you could roleplay, cosplay as Zed from Zardoz?
even if. No. So it's just one of those weird things. It has gotten really, really big. And, you know, we have this other news article that you pointed out, which talks about just how big, like, the RPG market is. And it's not as big as people think it is. So what is actually driving that? And I guess when you look at the next article, I'm going to say it's every other game on the planet. You know, because any world has this. We'll link it in the show notes, to how big the RPG market is. And they say the total gaming market between U.S. and Canada is $1.19 billion. And out of that, that's dollars U.S., by the way. Yep. And out of that, the RPG market is only less than 3%, about $35 million.
Yep.
Which sounds like a lot. Until you start splitting that up between, you know, drive-through and Wizards and Paizo, and I'm
thinking this is the profit, not necessarily the total expenditure money.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so that would make sense. Yeah.
This is, and the biggest segment is still collectible card games. You know,
yeah.
Pokemon, Magic the Gathering is still probably pretty high up there. You know, those type of things, which for a company like Wizards of the Coast is good because they have a lot of collectible card games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which makes Hasbro very happy.
Yep. And probably keeps Wizards in under the Hasbro umbrella too.
Right.
Yep.
You know, but even board games is 21% of the market, which that makes a lot of sense. I mean, they're at what here? 250 million? is what I think is what that says. It's hard to see because it's yellow, white on yellow.
Yeah,
guys,
that's
yeah. Guys could have chosen a slightly different color.
Yep.
And you know, card and dice games is more than, you know, role playing games at $105 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how much of that includes Monopoly, Yahtzee,
well, that's,
Risk,
I think
that
that's
kind
in the,
of stuff?
I think that goes in the board game market more than some of the other ones.
Yeah, but it could be something like Zombie Dice or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think the weird thing about the card and dice and the board games, I'm sure it's pretty hard to differentiate which is which.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was kind of wondering. I'm like, card and dice games and then board games. I'm like, okay, so is Yahtzee a board game or I mean, obviously it's a dice game, but is it counted as a board game?
I think probably if it's from one of the traditional board game makers, it's probably counted as a board game.
Probably.
Because that's how it's probably reported out. They're just like umbrella board game category. They probably don't do a card and dice category.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
To be fair, I would probably combine these two categories just to say board game, card, and dice. And I know that people are like, well, that's crazy. But, well, that's the way it kind of goes. But, yeah, you know, 52.5% of the market is the collectible card games. So that's
Well, even the miniatures market is larger than, you know, the RPG market by, you know, by about five times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing there.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I mean, that makes sense. You know, there's a lot of people that still play Warhammer. And that falls under that category. There's a lot of other miniature games, including, you know, like the various Star Wars miniature games that came out, that Fantasy Flight did, and some of the other ones. What was that?
Well, what about the historical reenactments? Do they still do those, or?
I don't know.
Civil War II's, or?
Yeah, those are probably still under miniatures. See, that's where it gets funky, because, like, there's other games. I don't know whether they count them as, again, are they board games, are they card and dice, because you have things like Memoir 44, you have, you know, which is not quite a miniature game, but it's not quite a board game, even though it has.
And you also
have
like Flames of War, which is miniatures,
right?
Which is you know, straight historical, and yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, what's weird is when you compare the RPG market against the profits of a single blockbuster film at about $38 billion on the average, it's tiny. I mean, it's like a 40th upper percent. And then you compare it to the video game market. I mean, and that's the thing. People, well, you know, I guess there's a lot of influence, video game influence, obviously at the conventions like Gen Con. But it's not like people are playing the video games there, because I mean, even the video games have their own conventions.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know about you. I'm not sure what the... I don't think I've ever seen any Gen Con statistics about what kind of people go. Versus, you know, are they mostly RPGers? What's their primary? Not everything that they're doing there, but what's the primary reason that they've gone? That would be an interesting survey.
It would.
You know, because I think that would actually tell them maybe who their market is. Because, I mean, otherwise you don't know. I mean, because there's a lot of RPG games, obviously, at Gen Con. I'm not going to dismiss that. And they're almost always sold out.
Well, yeah, so it wouldn't be that hard to set it up with the tickets. When you get your tickets, you just fill out your demographic information at the same time. And I'm sure they have a bit of data to base with it nowadays.
Yeah. I guess my point is I've never seen any of that published, really. Unless you have.
Yeah.
If one of our listeners knows if any of that data has actually been published, please let us know, because I think that would be fascinating to look at.
Yeah.
So. All right. So we, and of course, we have the innies coming.
Yep.
Which means that we'll probably do our obligatory innie episode soon, because Gen Con is in August, right?
Yes.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. I forget the exact date. Let's see. It is 17th through the 20th. So,
okay, so they're back again for a change. Last year was kind of weird because it was in the beginning of the month as opposed to near the end of the month.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just has to do with when they can actually get the convention hall.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So, I mean, you figure most of these conventions, convention halls, their schedule is booked 2 or 3 years in advance at the very least, if not probably up to four.
Well, Gen Con's got to start reaching one of those kind of we'll make room for you on the schedule levels, though. I mean, they're selling out of 4-day passes. They got to be looking at least 50,000 people.
Oh, probably, definitely more than that. I think they had 66,000 unique people last year.
Yep.
Wow.
So, no, it's going to be interesting. So we'll see. And of course, this year, well, you know, the big draw this year might be the fact that this is the 50th year. It's the, what do you call this? The half central.
It's the
diamond, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not like bicentennial. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you go along with the British concept of it, it's like the Diamond Jubilee for Shanghai.
Yes, there we go.
Again, it's going to be fun. Although it does feel kind of weird that it's the 50th anniversary, and while it feels bigger than big, the main movers and shakers aren't really doing anything exciting for Gen Con, as far as I can tell. Just the same old business as usual.
I think that's just the way it is. But anyway, the innies will be there, and so the nominees have been released, and the voting is July 11th, which basically means from the time that you hear this episode to the 10 days afterwards, you can vote. So we'll do our obligatory let's guess the innies, and you know, between the three of us, we'll probably get most of them right.
Exactly.
And it's not, you know, and I hate, we always talk about it. It's not that we're saying that it's rigged, but it's just, it's pretty easy to guess what most people are going to think. Every once in a while we're wrong, but I think between three people, we usually get a pretty good bead on what's going to be probably what most people are going to vote for, even when we haven't seen the projects.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
I think that's the scary part. It's like, you can almost guess. So.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only time that you don't know is when they, you know, but there's no way. It's just the way the systems are, and I think almost all awards tend to go one way anyway. You know.
Yeah.
It's an award. But
but at the same time, last year was kind of fun because it was a bit of an anomaly year where it was Kenneth Haidt and Robin D. Laws running away with a good chunk of the change, you know, for a change, as opposed to just Lochte or Pathfinder.
Right. So all right, let's get into the first topic so we can get power through this episode because, you know, we have a lot of stuff to talk about. And, of course,
we do.
First up, yeah. Cyberpunk, which,
oh yeah,
you know, it's weird because we're now living in the era that a lot of the early Cyberpunk games were set in terms of timeline.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you look at Cyberpunk, the original Cyberpunk, I think it was supposed to be 2013, and then Cyberpunk 2020 was in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those obviously, you know, Mike Pondsmith did those, and that's, I don't know if I don't know if there were Cyberpunk RPGs before Cyberpunk. I know there were a lot after. I think it, in many ways, I don't know, is it the first, really? It's kind of considered the granddaddy of them all.
Well, when GURPS Cyberpunk came out in 1991, when did Cyberpunk come out? Well, Shadowrun was 86, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think the original Cyberpunk... Here, let's find out. The original Cyberpunk 2013 took place... Of course, it doesn't say right off the bat. That would make things too easy.
And then... I mean, did Traveler play any part into the Cyberpunk setting at all?
Not really.
Okay.
2013 was published in 1988.
Okay, that I would argue is probably the first one here, ultimately, unless we can find one that's sooner.
Well, Shadowrun, I think, was 86, wasn't it?
No, or, well, no, Shadowrun was way later.
Yeah. There's basically a response there. The original Shadowrun took place in 1989.
Yeah, they were a lot around the same time, but most people I know, they always consider, even if it's not true, they always kind of consider this Cyberpunk game kind of the first one out of the gates.
Okay.
So.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's okay. But it's kind of weird, you know, they're set in our time, and... Mm-hmm. You know, it's weird that to be living now and trying to decide whether, you know, what they were saying. You know, I look at it from the standpoint of it's like, you know, I think a lot of it had to do with, especially in the 80s, we were very pessimistic about lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
At least the U.S. as a society, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, we We did really think that, you know, obviously, like, Japan was going to own everything.
Yep.
You know, and it's funny how that didn't quite turn out to be true, and actually Japan had its own financial troubles.
Yeah.
So, but it's also weird how certain things from the cyberpunk movement, in many ways, some of the predictions, if you squint your eyes just enough, you're like, that kind of came true.
Yeah, maybe only the themes have really changed. Yeah. Like, ultimately, cyberpunk comes down to 10 key points that seem to be reoccurring themes within the actual cyberpunk genre. Well, first, it's got to be a dystopia.
Right.
You know, you're not going to have a utopian cyberpunk game, otherwise you're playing some weird space opera game.
Right.
And if there are four words that define the genre more than any others. High tech, low life. You have the toys, you have the advanced cybernetics, you have the advanced stuff, but then you have people starving in the streets who are basically fighting tooth and nail to just live. And the have and the have-nots have such an extreme disparity that's even worse than, you know, as much as we joke about the one percenters today, compared to a cyberpunk world, it's relatively equal.
Right.
And then again, you get your certain elements of hard-boiled noir, because there's always that dark, gritty feel of the game, where they're technically heroes.
Yeah, I mean, that's, in many ways, that was always especially important in the game, was mm-hmm. that noir feeling. Mm-hmm. Like, you could step in a Humphrey Bogart movie and just add technology, and you'd be okay. it would be almost a very similar setting.
Yeah, it brings on a whole new feeling to the words, here's looking at you, kid, if you have cybernetic eyes.
Yeah.
Okay. Additionally, there's always the playing of the mega corporations. The idea that corporations are too big to literally fail.
That sounds familiar, doesn't it?
That's probably the most closest to home when it comes to this thing here.
Right.
You know, it's ultimately a cyber world, and it almost always takes something we don't really have right now, the strong AI position. Whereas life, cybernetic life is just around the corner, if it's not already here.
Right. I mean, I know Cyberpunk 2020, there were AIs, and there was even, I think, talk of rogue AIs, and I think even Shadowrun has all that too, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then, of course, the big one that you mentioned, Jeff, is America has been supplanted as top dog by some other up-and-coming power. In the 80s, it was Japan. But you could argue that now we'd probably be more scared of, say, China.
Or just corporations in general, where the corporations supplanted the nation as a whole, supplanted a nation as a whole, instead of allegiance to a nation, it was allegiance to a corporation. Or even, you know, syndicates and that kind of thing. So I think there was an element of the consumerism kind of taking over and becoming the government, as it were.
Oh, agree completely. Like, we're going to talk about movies later, but I always, again, one of my favorite scenes in cyberpunk of all time is actually from RoboCop 2, where the old man looks right at the camera and says, anybody can buy stock. What could be more democratic than that? And I always love that aspect, which we will get to later. And of course, one of the big things is, despite the advanced technology, the narrator and or characters will not take time to explain the technology they're dealing with, because the amazing has become mundane. Like, no matter how advanced it is, it's other than a little bit of ooking. You're not going through the retro future concept where it's the future and everything's so amazing. Even if it is bloody amazing, usually you're trying to avoid it because it's trying to kill you.
Right.
In some ways or form. Like, hey, that's really cool. Oh, wait, it's trying to kill me. Go away. And that's part of the fun when it comes to stuff like that. Of course, there's the overall dehumanization where humans have become cogs in the machine, which kind of plays back to high-tech, low-life. And, of course, the big one that basically helped start the genre, which I don't know if it's so much true anymore, is the concept of the punk with the cyber, where implications of rebellion, do-it-yourselfism, and anarchy is integrated heavily here. Like, you can't rely on the man anymore because he's probably trying to kill you or exploit you in some way, shape, or form. So you got to get your buddies together and basically rage against the machine. And sometimes that's literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there was a certain element of music that was incorporated into the games of the time. You know, the musical movements of the 80s and 90s kind of influenced that to a certain extent, too. Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know about you, but I would basically be listening to heavy metal and the Ramones for a good chunk of this thing if I was trying to get the real feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you mix the two together, you get some really fun stuff. And of course, you got to mix in some synthesizers.
Well, you put in early Nine Inch Nails, yeah. That kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is an interesting mix. I mean, in many ways, today, if you were going to put this in, you know, if you were going to include a music that kind of pushes the cyberpunk concept, oddly, it would be rap music in many ways, even though rap at a certain level has become very corporatized.
Oh,
you know, it's
interesting.
Like, what?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because, I mean, if you take early rap, you know, that was very down, dirty, gritty, you know, especially mm-hmm. when you look at it from the people, you know, somebody who has a message that they want to speak out about, and, you know, that's their form for it, where, you know, I mean, and I guess there's always been that in rap music, where there's always more hard-edge rap artists versus non, and I'm a white guy, so I don't know what I'm completely talking about.
No worries. Yeah, we're not probably much better when it comes to it, considering our demographic and our gender. But yeah, basically, hip hop would probably be the music most likely to be used in a modern environment, which we will talk about later because actually somebody made a game like that.
All right.
Okay, so that's awesome. Well, ultimately, common cyberpunk role playing scenarios usually end up as the job. The party is hired by somebody or another to do something for pay.
And it's usually not legal or questionably legal or anything like that.
Yeah, there's always a kind of a gray tone to it, at least, at the very least. Otherwise, it wouldn't feel like noir.
Exactly.
And kind of broke it down to four basic concepts for a cyberpunk adventure. You're a courier, like Johnny Mnemonic. You have to get X to Y, whether it's somebody or something. It's the heist. Because if you played enough Shadowrun, that's pretty much 85% of your games. You're trying to break in somewhere and grab something or someone.
Yep.
Whether it's a rescue, whether it's a kidnapping, whether it's I want to grab this data pad, whether I want to grab into the net and grab that little bit of code, or whether I want to grab a cure, it's all the same. Conversely, protection is the other side of that coin. You're bodyguards, or you're building a defense, or you're about to be attacked by a bunch of roaming bikers. You know, your local home turf, you better get packed up and get it ready for the fight, because the booster gang is about to show up. And the fourth one seems to be the one that's almost like the odd man out. Terrorists. Terrorists are frighteningly common in cyberpunk. They could range from religious fanatics, corporate raiders, doomsday cults, or cyber hackers. Or even they could be rogue cyborgs AIs. Like, if you played enough cyberpunk, you get scared when you hear these two words together, booster gang. Because they're basically roving gangs of sociopathic cyborgs running around kicking the crap out of just about everybody. And if you're the poor cop with a 9mm gun, you feel really inadequate for the situation.
Yep, pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh, I do like your one of the common aspects that you listed here.
Oh?
Yeah, you said you have common aspects. It's like betrayal from employers.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's a common trope in lots of games. I mean, any game where the players are doing something that's either questionably legal or outside the normal realm of the law.
Yeah.
You know, that,
like,
and it doesn't matter who your employer is, be it corporation, government, whatever.
Yeah.
I think the players almost expect to be betrayed, and I've actually surprised players a couple of times by not betraying them. They're like, oh, he's just going to give us the money? Okay.
Yeah. One of the weird things about cyberpunk is there's a big question that needs to be answered if you're going to run your game before you even start. To space or not to space? Because cyberpunk has both a space presence and not a space presence, depending on which version you're playing. Like Blade Runner, the original, you know, the movie with Harrison Ford,
right,
kept talking about being off planet. But the adventure itself never took place off planet.
Right.
You know, they were never at the moon. They were never traveling the stuff there in order to do so. So it's kind of like, give cyberpunk, you know, you're stuck on Earth and everybody else is in the heavens. So, you know, it almost gives you almost a biblical feel to the game if you do it right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even, you know, cyberpunk had a supplement for Near Earth, a Near Space or whatever it was called.
Exactly.
So, and other games, depending, Yeah, I've seen it all. It's like even if you take like games that do have a that's mainly a main space presence, like you take, you know, used to be it was Traveler 2300, but they renamed it to 2300 AD. One of their books was actually on Earth. It was more cyberpunkish, and elsewhere it was more sci-fi. You know, so they had a if you went back to Earth, you were going to deal with cybernetics and cybernetic implants and stuff. Whereas if you went further out in the system, you weren't dealing with that. So, you know, it actually kind of goes both ways depending on what kind of game you're running.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you could easily incorporate elements if you're stuck on a, let's say you're stuck on the moon and there's a major moon colony there, but you also have $5 to your name and are stuck there. Suddenly you're playing a cyberpunk game. Because you got to basically try to scrape up enough money to get back, or maybe you don't want to. Maybe you want to be one of the mover shakers there. And, you know, just part of the fun. Anywho, now we get to our favorite part, which is media. I just threw down about five or six of what I consider the most essential books. Some range from just aspects, some range for other stuff here. Like, I'm going to start with a book that's going to be kind of controversial for the cyberpunk movement, but I'd argue in many ways helps set up the first part. It's the dystopian book 1984 by George Orwell. It set up the dystopia concept to begin with, that eventually further material would start rebelling against in order to get things together. The repackaging of words. It
Oh,
was done
yeah.
by a government, later it would be done by companies. And I don't think I've heard a single cyberpunk game where you don't end up creating your own lingo in the process, or there's not ones already created.
Yeah, I know Cyberpunk had a list of lingo that they created.
Or, you know, if you play Shadowrun, you know everybody here knows what a Mr. Johnson is. Because that's your employer who wants to remain anonymous. And crap like that is how you define the culture, is by their cultural words. And in many ways, I consider 1984 to define, be one of the first greatest examples of that. By changing the words, you change the meanings, and therefore you control the language. And this, even though it's not cyberpunk per se, this is what you're rebelling against. And then we get on to, of course, Neuromancer. We can also do some of the other books here, but since it's the first one, it gets mentioned first here. How this book is the most cyberpunk of cyberpunk books. It is the book that launched a thousand other books, and it's a whole bunch of other movies. It defined the genre, the idea of the hacker, the idea of the setup here, in order to get things going. Then we get to books like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which ultimately became Blade Runner. Well, the original book isn't that sci-fi in comparison. It's not really cyberpunk. It defined concepts like what, how do androids work within society, whether they're expendable, and so forth. And even if it has such weird responses according to it really, Philip K. Dick is probably one of the most underrated writers of his era because how he liked to play with mind games when it comes to a lot of his material. Then I'm going to throw in the book Transmetropolitan by, you know, basically imagine a outlawed journalist based on Hunter S. Thompson. It's literally one of the greatest graphic novels ever made, but it's not, definitely not for children. And it takes place in a dystopian future where what does a journalist do when they have no, none of the power? Because the main character is easily the most punk of the cyberpunk characters I think I've ever seen. He gets his ass kicked many, many times, but he ultimately wins because he's able to play the game. And, well, that's the ones I want to mention. Do you guys have any others you want to mention?
No,
Well,
oh, do you have a book?
I was just going to say the Netrunner Android novels from Fantasy Flight Games. I think Mel Odom did a three series, a trilogy of them. They're actually quite good. They're very noir with a lot of the cyberpunk elements, only it is kind of, it's nice because it's kind of updated to with the contemporary ideas of instead of the advancements in transportation and robotics and stuff like that, the advancements in communications are what define it as, or are what kind of advances the technology in it, which is where, you know, a lot of the visionaries of yesteryear thought we would have these advances in transportation and robotics when it was mostly communications. And so they're actually quite good. I read the first three and I really enjoyed them, so I would definitely recommend those.
Interesting. I look forward to taking a look at them and seeing what comes out of them. Okay. I guess we could.
Now we move on to probably the more interesting one, which is movies. Which,
hey, what?
Yeah, I mean, you have the list here, and it's weird because the first one on the list, because it's alphabetical, but makes a lot of sense, is Akira.
Yes.
Yep.
And,
It's a bunch. Yeah. Go on, sorry.
well, it's much more, obviously. The movie is, for those who've never seen it, try to watch it. It won't make any sense probably the first time you watch it. You'll have to watch it like three times before it makes any sense. And it's gorgeously animated in a way that, because they hand mixed some of those paints to get the colors. And it shows. This was before digital, before you did everything digitally. So it is quite amazing. But it's also quite confusing. You have those elements of kind of telepathic mental powers, which kind of throws people, but you have this dystopian future. You have biker gangs on motorcycles. I think that movie really set the whole, for most cyberpunk settings, anytime there's a biker gang, this movie used the proto has the prototype for the biker gangs.
Not gonna disagree on that one there.
They just released a 25th anniversary Blu-ray of it, and they had a really interesting featurette on it about the music, the soundtrack for Akira, which is not to everyone's taste, but when you see the work that went into just doing that soundtrack, it's amazing. It's mind-blowing.
Absolutely. It's possible to like a work of art and not like, for appreciate for what they did, even if you don't like it. But I like this movie. Actually, I like most of these movies on this list.
Yeah, well, I mean, you list, of course, Ghost in the Shell, which is probably another classic. They did the live action. I've not seen the live action. I've seen the original anime, and it's like, I don't know why I would watch the live action. Have you guys seen the live action?
Nope.
I have actually. It's not as bad as I thought it would be, but okay, they nailed Batu, who's one of my favorite characters, and Scarlett Johansson did a decent enough job, but it felt like, well, you could tell they were trying to cater to the audience, and they did a few scenes that don't quite make total sense. But to be fair, it's under the original, so I'm gonna give them a bit of a buy. Like, it's as good as an American remake as you're gonna get. After all, I've seen the original Dragon Ball remake, and trust me, comparatively, this piece is a piece of gold. Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say on that one.
Yeah,
But
but it's interesting. Some of the ones on this list are. It's funny because they're early cyberpunk references for movies, even though cyberpunk wasn't even a concept then. You have like Escape from New York. You have Rollerball. Both of
yes.
both of which are this dystopian future. And I think anytime I've ever seen a cyberpunk game, usually these movies are listed as references.
Running Man, yep.
Yeah, well, The Running Man, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I've rented that movie way too many times lately, but
Oh,
that's okay.
and of course RoboCop. I mean, that's actually kind of a weird classic in that aspect. And not the
RoboCop's almost the definitive this side of, other than Blade Runner,
Yeah.
of cyberpunk for the mass media,
Yeah.
because
And when we talk we
it's.
and we mentioned when we talk RoboCop, we're talking the original RoboCop movie with Peter Weller.
Yeah, quite literally, I'll buy that for a dollar.
Exactly. So,
And again, there's always lots of other fun stuff here. Like I mentioned Heavy Metal the movie, but primarily mentioned it for one of my favorite, which is the film noir experience at the beginning of the movie. For the
right.
first scene where you got the New York taxi cop in space New York who gets stuck in a film noir. They even had people with cybernetics. It literally was a pitch perfect cyberpunk thing. The only difference is they had a little bit more aliens than they did in, pretty much traditional cyberpunk.
Right.
Which, of course, casts its reflection onto Fifth Element. Bruce Willis's character in Fifth Element. I mean, you can see that almost a direct relation between that first segment of heavy metal on Fifth Element there. So.
Oh, I agree completely here because you got a teeming city of Metropolis, as it were. And yes, I mentioned Metropolis on this list as well, despite being made in the 30s, because it literally is a class struggle done in the 30s. Like, it's the wrong era, but it's the right feel.
Right. And so,
Makes
yeah,
sense.
I'm well, not only that, it has robots, and so it kind of has cybernetics. And you're right, it has, the have and the have nots.
Yeah.
So,
And they basically treat the Metropolis as the Tower of Babel. And it becomes a Christian analogy, which is something really weird I've been noticing a lot in Cyberpunk. There's a lot of Christian overtones if you start looking for them. Figure that one out. Anyways, I'm gonna, of course, one of the ones I'm gonna bring up that might be kind of a little bit outside the normal context, but I consider them to be, if not Cyberpunk movies, influenced by them. Alien and Aliens. Because the original Alien crew is just a bunch of working blokes on a ship. They're not the best of the best. They're not some great heroes. They're just doing a mining operation, coming back, and they land on the wrong planet at the wrong time. And it's weird that for all the future movies, Ridley Scott doesn't get it for every other movie where he basically makes them play like idiots. This group may have died, but they didn't die like idiots. They screw up here and there, but generally speaking, it's honest screw-ups, not, "Hi, I'm an engineer. I'm going to take my helmet off." And
Right.
that always bugged the crap out of me in things like Prometheus. Okay.
And of course, you list Tron on here, and you can't talk about Tron because most early concepts of at least for what the net or the VR for the net would look like almost had very a lot of them had very Tron-like elements.
Absolutely. Yep.
As the first AI, it's an AI, you go into the machine, it's based on a mega corporation. In
Right.
fact, I would recommend a series that I consider one of the greatest animated shows in the last 15, last 5 years, Tron Uprisings. They do it between Tron and Tron Legacy. They get most of the cast together. It's an all-star cast. It looks beautiful. And it takes place on the grid.
Except you
And
can't get it on DVD.
which is still breaks my heart, man, because it's okay. Anybody who's got of a certain age remembers Transformers the movie where we got to see all our heroes die. It has that same effect because they're just bits. And it's harsh, man, but it's brilliant.
All right. There is a TV show. We're gonna go down to the TV shows. You
Sure.
mentioned one of the TV shows, which honestly, to me, was so way ahead of its time, but is has a major cyberpunk feel. Max
Yes.
Headroom. And I don't know. There weren't that many episodes. What, like 13, maybe, or
There's
less?
only about are 14 episodes.
There you
Okay.
go. And it's one of those weird shows that it was so way ahead of its time in terms of what it was talking about that I don't think people got it. I really
Absolutely.
don't.
Well, an interesting thing, if you go back and watch it, is it has kind of a retro punk look to it. And this will make sense in a moment when I explain. If you go back and look at it, you'll notice that they're typing on typewriters and they're using small CRTs for all their displays and stuff like that. So it still has it has that contemporary, for the time anyway, look and feel, but the technology has a certain retro aspect to it while still being cyberpunk. It's a really interesting, unfortunately, I actually got to see a live reading of George R. R. Martin's unproduced Christmas script for this up in Santa Fe with Matt Frewer doing the voice of Max Headroom live there.
Damn.
And it was, I mean, it was an amazing experience. It was fantastic. It was a nice little theater, the whole nine yards. But they showed the last couple episodes, and it's a really interesting show. And but yeah, it's it is it kind of defines it has so many elements of the cyberpunk movement slash ideal in
Yeah.
there.
I still say one of my favorite characters from that was Blank Reg.
Blank Reg, yep.
Running the little pirated TV station.
Yep.
Dude, you got this pirate TV station in a freaking minivan where he's got him and his wife, and they're basically, and his dog, and they're driving around. He's effectively zeroed. He's off the grid. He doesn't have a number. And as a result, he's basically scavenging on the mean streets, and how he does it is with television. And it's kind of mind blowing, as well as stuff like literacy, how there's actually, you can get charged for teaching people how to educate them without paying the proper bills. Or the game shows where if you get stuck on a thing, you go up against a lawyer or judge on TV and it gets televised.
Right.
Or you
Or
can't turn off your television.
you can't turn
Yeah, it's
off
a
your
crime.
television, or you vote by candidates get elected into office by which network sponsors them and has the highest rating at a certain point.
Yes.
So there's just so much in there, and it's not, well, not only that, but I think even like body, you know, like the concept of even like body banks, I think
Yep.
originated in that show, and it permeated to like cyber, you know, I know Cyberpunk 2020 had body banks and that kind of concepts. So it's just fascinating, you know, when you get down to it, you know, that it influenced so many other things. And I mean, you list a few others here, which, you
No
know,
worries, Ben.
yeah, I
But
mean,
yeah, I
it's hard.
think we missed one of the major influences, though. What about Judge Dredd's influence on Cyberpunk?
Yes,
Yes,
82,000.
yeah. If you go to the comics, definitely. You know, I mean, obviously they're not listed here, but yeah, that was probably a major influence. And again, I think a lot of it had to do with the time frame that Cyberpunk really became more of a thing than anything else. And it is. It's an interesting. I guess my question. I mean, let's get down to the RPGs, because there are. You know, we want to get to the other topic, and but you know, you have Cyberpunk 2020. You have. I've never heard of Headspace.
It was one of our Kickstarters we did a while back.
Okay.
Basically, it's a cyberpunk aspect game where you are building a party that's taking place in there. You're all badasses, but it's almost more of a narrative game because one person of your party has died already before the game starts, and you're basically compensating with it for baggage and stuff. Like, She's a Super Geek does an amazing job with this, if you want to hear how it actually plays out. But it's basically one of the things I notice is cyberpunk games get later and later in the game. It becomes less about the toys and more about the feel, for lack of a better term. And this is almost the quintessential element. And then, of course, I cannot mention cyberpunk without mentioning GURPS Cyberpunk, or the, it's not the greatest book in the world, but its history behind it is phenomenal.
Yes. Yep.
It is the book that got taken out by the F, was it the FBI?
Yes, the FBI.
Yeah, because it was basically stop in order to do so here. You need to read this book, even though others have surpassed it, because it's a piece of history as much as it is a role-playing game.
And then you have Rifts listed, which is, you know,
Yeah. Well, again,
it's not, it's more
no, it's not.
anime than cyberpunk, but it has some of those elements obviously in it. And then of course you talk about Shadowrun, which is one of those weird games because it's a hybrid. It's a
Well,
fantasy
right.
cyberpunk.
It's one of the most cyberpunk games, but it's also a heavy dose of fantasy thrown in there into the mighty stew.
Right.
You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. It's as simple as that.
And obviously you list some of the Kickstarters, and you have Interface 0.2.0 for Pathfinder, but it's actually a Savage World game.
Oh, terrible, sorry.
Yeah, so there is actually an Interface 0.2.0 Savage World book. I have it.
Okay.
No, I mean, no, they're doing a
Oh, they do.
Pathfinder version, but there is a Savage World version.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So.
Yeah, and of course, Axiom Pub Overdrive is the one I was talking about, how they redid Cyberpunk through the lens of hip hop.
Right. I
And
think we mentioned that on the show.
oh,
Yeah.
absolutely. And I guess if you want to see how Cyberpunk can be reinterpreted through a different era, this will be something you might get really interested in. Okay. Actually, I got to fix the next one, which is video games. I only have two I really want to mention. Half-Life 2, in many ways, is the quintess is it's not the quintessential cyberpunk game, but Freeman, you got to give him credit. He's stuck in a parallel, you know, basically has dimensional people that have taken over the world. It's dystopian, and he literally has to fight the power of the people, using all sorts of weird, you know, tech and or to deal with weird situations and so forth. Plus, you're using conventional technology against the person. Like you got your, you know, you got a vehicle, but you got it's basically held together by duct tape and Tinker Toys. And while you may have a gravity gun, more often than not, you have to pull ye olde crowbar. So it's kind of a combination of that high tech, low life feel for the game for the silent protagonist. And the other is actually System Shock, both 1 and 2, where you get to see what Cyberpunk kind of looks like in space, or what happens when you take the ethics off a computer, and what goes wrong. Because I argue that Shodan's one of the greatest female villains of all time. Even though she's kind of cartoony, she's terrifying when you think about it. Especially when you got an ally with her in the second game, only you don't know it for a good chunk of it. But when I originally played the game and you turn the corner and you end up in this room filled with monitors and you see Shodan's face, I got a little terrified, I ain't gonna lie there. And the fact that you're basically a character who's a Borg, who's being augmented little by little, especially in the second game, where you're getting it from Shodan, who wants to essentially take over the universe, even though she wants to stop her children in the second game. It has almost more in common with Alien and Aliens than it does with more traditional cyberpunk, but there are heli-filthy elements of it there.
Okay.
Alrighty. I'm going to leave it with one more thought before we go on to the next topic. I kind of want to ask the listeners if they feel that is cyberpunk as a setting, is it something that makes more sense now, or was it more a product of the time before? You know, like in the 80s where things were really bleak, or are things bleak enough now that do you still have cyberpunk, but it's just morphed into something else than what it was?
Good question.
That's a very good question.
So, all right, let's go into the next topic, which of course is, you know, the desert.
Yep.
And desert adventures. And of course, this is in honor of the fact that I've been having, 113, 114, I think we had 120 a while back, days here in Phoenix.
Oh, we're just in the upper 90s and low 100s here, so we're,
Yeah, well, we're not as hot as we were, but we were really hot at one point. We've hit some record-setting days.
Mm-hmm.
And before we go, of course, is the fact that, well, not all deserts are alike.
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people, they think deserts, they think of, the Sahara High Desert, basically. Mm-hmm. Where it's just sand upon sand upon sand. And anyone who obviously lives in Arizona, or pretty much, I guess, in the Southwest in a lot of ways, they know that there's desert landscape, and it is not as bleak as it looks. But it just means that you don't get a lot of rainfall.
Right.
So. Where do you want to go with this one? Should we start?
Well, I guess the big question is why deserts? Ultimately, I thought to say we could pick a random terrain and see if it's gameable. And since Jeff lives in Phoenix, it seemed like a good one to start with. And ultimately, how does desertification occur? It's everything ranging from climate change, magical instigation, droughts, or nuclear fallout. It ultimately is an environment that's doesn't look like it's teeming with life, but more often than not is. It might just not be life you're familiar with. Historical accounts of desertification or events include Rome and Northern Africa, especially some of the salting of the earth that occurred there. The Bronze Age collapse basically happened in the Middle East and destroyed civilization for quite a few hundred years that we're still not sure exactly what happened. Of course, the Bible refers heavily to deserts. The Crusades is a place that took place primarily in the Middle East, although some of it happened in Northern Europe. Of course, we got to talk about World War I with Lawrence of Arabia, which is pretty much the pinnacle of a desert adventure. And of course, if you're going for World War II, you got to talk about the Africa Corps, the great fights in the northern, from all the way from Tunisia to Egypt, where you were using tanks in position against the shrewd desert fox, Rommel.
Hmm.
And there's all sorts of true geographic features. You got everything from anvils, you got sand, you got, in some cases, you have the polar ones, where essentially both poles are considered deserts because of how little rainfall that actually happens there. Or the Gobi Desert, which is actually a coal desert, despite of itself, just really dry because of it. And how dangers include, but are not limited to, things like dehydration, dust devils, flash floods, the overall glare, extreme heat and cold, the sandstorms and the sand wind, and of course the overall sand dunes.
Yeah.
And of course, mirages.
Yeah.
Because you stare at the sand long enough, you'll see things. And you probably won't want to see those things. And then you get stuff like oases, salt plains, or salt karsts.
Yeah.
Or salt things that aren't to do so. Now, deserts happen all over the place throughout fiction. So I decided to list some of my favorite great fictional deserts. Like Anorak, which is in the Forgotten Realms, which essentially is a desert created by a bunch of flying sock monsters, for lack of a better term. Well, they are. They're called the Phrenium. Basically, they're the reason why Netherrealm fell, at least in part. And because they had destroyed the goddess of magic, the Phrenium basically got loose and essentially desertified the heck out of this area where it should be relatively plain territory. And another idea is the plains of purple dust in the Rotten Desert, where you had a great magical civilization go against a great priest civilization, Imaskar versus Moldoran, and it's the baseline for one of the greatest module series of all time, the Desert of Desolations. And the Sea of Dust is in the Greyhawk worlds, where there's this great empire. I can't remember what they're called again. But they're the basis for the Scarlet Brotherhood. They used to have there used to be essentially a human supremacist organization that went from there. And of course, space is notorious for the desert planet. Whether it's Dune, whether it's Tatooine in Star Wars, whether it's the planet Vulcan in Star Trek, or Mars of John Carpenter of Mars. Then you get to stuff like related terrain, such as Badlands, glass terrain, petrified terrain, or steppe, that are not quite deserts, but they're close enough for the purposes of this article here and our discussion. Yeah. And then we get to fauna. So I'm going to ask you guys, what comes to mind when you start thinking of critters from the desert?
Oh, you really want to know?
Sure. Well, hey, you're our guide here, man.
Well, at least in the Southwest here, you have coyotes, you have scorpions, you have, honestly, bunnies, rabbits, you have desert bears, snakes by a bunch of different types, you know, and then, of course, you have a whole bunch of the various birds, especially the ones that eat you after you're dead.
Like vultures and stuff?
Are other type of carrion eaters.
Wow.
You know, so, roadrunners. I mean, in Texas, there were roadrunners as well.
Yep.
You know, ground squirrels, you know, you name it. I mean, it is interesting. And of course, you know, obviously that's just here, but you know, and you mentioned bats. We do have bats here as well. Cause you know, it's interesting that it's a desert, but then we have some slightly mountainous or rocky terrain, and we do have caves and other places that they like to hang out.
Yeah. Insects are a big one too.
Yeah. Insects
just
in general.
Multitude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially spiders. There are we have a couple of poisonous varieties of spiders here around Albuquerque. And we have, ants. Ants are huge. There are multiple varieties around here, and they're not docile by any means. They will, I've literally had them swarm up my leg and bite me.
Ooh.
So they are unpleasant little creatures. So yeah, insects are a big thing, you know, because they're just ubiquitous.
Yeah,
and necessarily just the flying ones.
Oh no, no. It's interesting though, because you know when you look at deserts, and especially when you take into like the nuclear versions of the deserts, you know, you have obviously the mutated like insects, the giant ants, or other such nonsense.
Yeah,
that crop up. You know, you have various other desert creatures, or you know, you go, like you said, you go to Dune and you have the sandworms.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
Well, it is interesting from that aspect. And you know, and I think, you know, if you're running a fantasy or a science fiction game, obviously in a desert, you do actually have a little freedom to create your own creatures that fit that desert environment.
Absolutely.
Or it could or it could just be a nameless horror. I think in one of the adventures for Solomon Kane, I think one of the adventures has like some sort of creature that it literally just dehydrates everything. It's like where it is, it creates its own desert.
Yeah, I could see that. And that would also explain why the desert happened in the first place.
Exactly.
Another one is tumbleweeds.
Yes.
You know, they're kind of a staple of Westerns, but some of them can actually get quite large and heavy. And when the winds start blowing in a desert, suddenly things become serious. As Jeff has mentioned, they have sandstorms down there. We don't have them quite as bad here, but we still do get some sandstorms, and they will certainly exfoliate you.
I can believe it. And again, I would argue the single most common exaggerated monster in all of the desert lands has got to be the giant scorpion. Like, almost every environment, whether it's fantasy, whether it's sci-fi, has some weird variation of the giant scorpion as one of the creatures, because they're alien already. How scary would they be if they were bigger? It's as simple as that.
I mean, you almost can't have, like, a desert-slash-Egyptian-style campaign without giant beetles and Scorpions.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't happen.
Exactly. Well, unless there's anything else, we'll press on to all sorts of crazy fictional monsters. If the mundane monsters are crazy enough, there's a ton of insane monsters that are built throughout fiction. Like, I was looking through my Darwin's World books, and the first one that comes to mind is the concept of the desert enemy, which basically is a mutated, carnivorous, sessile plant that basically eats you. Or D&D, where the blue dragon resides, is in a desert. Or gnolls, or lamias, or sandlings, or that most legendary of monster, the Thrykreen, a.k.a. the bug people, who basically are scouring the desert and one of the poster child for Darkseid.
Well, you have the sand lions, too, from Pathfinder, which are effectively like the creature from the from Return of the Jedi.
Yeah,
the creatures that lie beneath the sand and then wait for people to come by. So,
yeah, absolutely. Those things are terrifying, even at low scale.
Yes.
Not to eat us. But then again, if they were that big, that's terrifying. In fact, I think they date back to the original Monster Manual, if memory serves me correctly.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Then you get into stuff like Deadlands, which, again, I think it's safe to assume we're all at least somewhat Deadland fans around here. And I want to bring up three in particular. The Jackalope, which is such a great twist on a horror that's based on an absolute way of life. Like when I was down in the Texas San Antonio area, they had these entire stores that were dedicated to building essentially taxidermy jackalopes. And it's kind of weird how horrific a monster they are in the Deadlands environment. And then, of course, you got the Mojave Rattlers, which are obviously an homage to the sandworms in Doom. And then you find out they're a horrible secret. They're actually imprisoned gods stuck in worm form. They were taken down by the Reckoners, and they want back. And you guys were talking about the tumbleweeds. They made a monster calibrated based on what I call the tumblebleeds, which essentially is a rolling monster that clamps on and acts as like a vampire and drains your blood. So, Yeah, it's lots of fun. We talked about sandworms already. In the Fallout environment, they have probably, I'd say, one of the most fun and yet somewhat terrifying monsters of all time. Are you guys familiar with what a Deathclaw is?
Yep.
Okay. A Deathclaw is a gecko that was mutated by radiation into a vaguely humanoid monster. And essentially, they're terrifying bruiser monster things. So, yeah, I think they're freaking amazing. Again, I think Fallout's amazing, so that's thinking what you will. You got Titan, the fantasy role-playing game, where you have the snake folk of the Karath, which often draws, they were essentially the snake folk of the desert who had all the science. Very evil, but very dangerous. And any other monsters you want to add to the list before we move on?
No, I think we can we can skip some of those, if there are any.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean,
I'm going to try to...
What was it?
Oh, no, go on, sorry.
No, I think we should really get into, you know, the desert cultures, because, you know, fauna's flora is not a big deal. I mean, there is flora, there is plants out there, but I mean, it really is the, you know, for a desert adventure, you know, there are different types of desert cultures. I mean, obviously there's the traditional nomadic ones,
the Bedouins,
right?
Yeah.
Which is what, when people think, you know, like Lawrence of Arabia and stuff, that's what they're really thinking is those guys. You know, I mean, even here, I mean, it's kind of funny when you look historically here, there were huge empires of people in the desert, and they survived. So
yeah, you got the ancient Bolivians, you got those entire desert complexes in places like Chaco Canyon.
Yep,
where you got people literally living on the side of cliffs. Also, you got, of course, you can't mention a desert culture without mentioning Egypt, even though its main reason for living was the fact that it wasn't in the desert, per se. It was kind of stuck on the lands on a big-ass river in the desert.
Yep. Right, but I mean, it's a backdrop to the culture. It's like, you know, basically you either lived on the Nile or you died in the desert.
Exactly.
Yep.
You know.
And everybody from original Greeks to Super Mario ripped off Egypt in some way, shape, or form. So they've literally become a mainstay of fantasy culture. We could practically do an entire section on them.
Yeah, we almost could.
Yeah. I got the listing of Gnostic cult here. That wasn't one of mine. Whose was it?
Nope. It's the. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not Gnostic. It's the Coptics, the Egyptian Coptics.
Oh, the Coptics.
Sorry. Got my things mixed up. I'm thinking of mages. The Awakening. Anyway, the Coptic, the Egyptian Coptics, who are a Christian cult, who originated down there, kind of interesting because they were, you know, they developed separately from some of the other Christian sects and stuff like that. So you have these different tribes and cultures that develop on their own in these isolated areas. And I mean, the very idea of a desert is isolation. So
I can see that. And that actually adds a really neat, amazing element to the thing when it comes down to it. Because how many civilizations rose and fall between the Euphrates and the Tigris River? A hell of a lot, I can assure you. Whether it's the Akkadians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians. Well, maybe the Persians a little too north, but you get the idea. And it's literally one of the most interesting places where cultures kept getting pushed up and down. And, you know, one of my favorite stories, I don't know if it's actually part of the desert proper, but I think it's close enough for purposes of this thing here, is a city called Dorinkiu, which is in Turkey, which is essentially a isolated city that's basically built into a mountain and into the earth. You know, it literally feels like a dwarven town, for lack of a better term, if you've ever seen the pictures of this sucker. It's really a work of art, and stuff like this can happen when you deal with people of the desert, because you got your bandits, you got your caravans, you got your nomads, and then you got your desert strongholds, whether you see this here or whether it's like the Foreign Legion of Northern Africa, where you got a bunch of French guys in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And well, let's push on. I think we're running out of time here a little bit. Role-playing material.
Oh my goodness, yeah, there's a lot of it.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume there's role-playing material from just about every other setting. So instead of giving you a list of like 50 products, let's just grab one and say why we like it or not like it for that matter.
Or, you know, what would out of the list, if you had to choose one, which would be, even though it's not, even if you didn't use it for the game, you think would be a quintessential read, which one do you think?
Okay.
I think that's probably a better question.
That sounds good. Who wants to go first? Okay. Go first then. Alkadim. I think it's one of the most original D&D environments they ever did. And it really does capture the 1001 Nights, even though the system itself is kind of second edition is showing its age, to put it mildly. I definitely would love to see it in a future edition. It's kind of amazing how much crap they were able to put into that thing, whether it was the genies, whether it was the Lost Civilizations. Like, it literally is a pitch perfect game. If you ever wanted to play Aladdin the TV series, which I consider to be one of the most quintessential desert adventure settings.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, you talked about it before, but I would definitely say, again, for D&D, I would have to say, you know, the whole Desert or Desolation series of adventures. I mean, it's almost a required read in a way. Because, I mean, that really gives you the idea of a really long, you know, desert adventure style, even if you don't use it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to dub crib from it and see where it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Paul, any ideas?
I've actually played through part of the Legacy of Fire for the Pathfinder RPG, and that was the adventures were, of course, a little suspect, but the setting's actually quite neat. They, you know, they incorporate djinn and a lot of the desert creatures. And I think that they did a good job with it. I mean, they have an entire section of their continent that's all, and it varies through the different desert environments. It's not just one big desert and then there's a city set in the center or anything like that. They do vary the desert environment like in the real world. So I think that they did a pretty good job with that. There are two APs related to that, the Legacy of Fire and Mummy's Mask.
Okay. Sounds amazing. So check it out. Because we talk about all sorts of crazy stuff here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's... Tell you what, let's do the same thing for movies. I guess pick one movie and see where it goes.
Oh, you actually have some good ones. I mean, honestly, in terms of, like, for a... almost like a dystopian one, you have to watch The Road Warrior for a desert movie.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, That would be my pick. I mean, that's like the quintessential like desert dystopian society movie.
Mm-hmm. Not disagreeing even in the slightest on that one.
I think I think for, if you want a good example of what it would be like to kind of adventure in the desert, especially from a fantasy perspective, I think Kingdom of Heaven has some good sequences in it that kind of, where an entire army is wiped out for lack of access to water.
Yeah, it shows you really what you need to actually survive in the Holy Lands, because the Holy Lands weren't really holy when it comes down to it. Because just the sheer butchery that happened during that period.
You know what? I was just thinking of another movie that's probably, in terms of a desert movie, probably one of the greater ones. And we mentioned it earlier, really.
Okay.
But we mentioned it as the real person, not the fictional account. But definitely Lawrence of Arabia.
Yep,
Oh.
agree completely.
You know, you almost cannot not watch that one if you're going to try to do anything in like a, even if you want to deal anything with like desert nomadic societies, that's just a good one to just watch to get an idea of how they may interact with each other.
Okay, and you just remind me of a movie that isn't on the list, but is definitely takes place at least partially in desert. Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh yeah.
You're literally the good chunk of the movie takes place in Egypt in a dig, where they're digging up the Ark of the Covenant, in the
Well,
middle
even
of the desert.
the third one too,
The Last Crusade.
the Last Crusade, also has some great desert sequences too. So.
And you can refer to stuff like Conan and so forth, or all the really awesome sword and sandal spaghetti movies that were done from the 60s to the 80s. But we'll let you guys find it out. If we missed a movie or a show or a game that you really were interested in, let us know.
So we want to try to curtail this and get the Kickstarters up and out of the way because, you know, we'd like to. But before we get to the Kickstarters, I think we need to mention the Bundle of Holding,
Okay.
which of
Oh.
course is Colonial Gothic,
Yep.
is the one. And this is I actually already posted about this, obviously, on Facebook. All the profits for this are actually going to a good charity, which is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Yep.
Okay, that's really good.
And of course, you know, I like the idea of, I've actually never played Colonial Gothic, but I've loved the idea of, and it's interesting because Colonial Gothic's here, and then there's going to be a Kickstarter that, honestly, in my opinion, it's just like, really? Don't we already have this game? And we'll talk about that when we hit it, but it definitely, I like the idea of like the hidden, you know, a hidden history in a game where, okay, this stuff happened, but then there's this other stuff that happened behind the scenes that most people don't know about. And obviously in Colonial Gothic, there's a whole bunch of, you know, magic related stuff.
Yep, it's got almost kind of I hate to use it, but it's almost got a kind of a Cthulhu feel to it. I had one of the first editions of Colonial Gothic. The system at the time was a little clunky, but I think they've improved it since. But yeah, it had a little bit of a that outer reaches kind of horror feel to it.
And honestly, for like $9, it gives you the core rule books for Colonial Gothic, and then I guess, is that an Adventure of the Flames of Freedom? Beginnings? Is that what that is?
I don't know.
I'm not gonna lie, he's gonna be angry, but I don't remember what that particular is. Oh yeah, it's an adventure. A
Oh,
hundred and
cool.
seventy-four page adventure.
Goodness gracious.
So that's pretty big. And then if you actually spend, I think, over $20.61, he also includes three setting books, three source books, Colonial Gothic Lovecraft, The Templars, The Defeated Dead, and The Landlord's Daughter, which I'm assuming The Landlord's Daughter and The Defeated Dead are also some more adventures. Oh, no. The Landlord's Daughter, Secret Societies, Pirates, Betrayal, Witchcraft, and Mysterious Illness. Yeah, so it's like a set of adventures. And then the other adventure, The Defeated Dead, is a ghost story of vengeful soldiers at the site of the U.S. Army's greatest defeat. So, all of which, honestly, is very cool. It has 8 days left to go. So, if nothing else for source material, I say get it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And not only that, but you're not only getting a good product, but you're also supporting a good cause.
Yep.
And again, I'm sure you'll find something in the product. Especially if you're stateside.
Oh, absolutely. So let's look. I hate to do this, but let's bring up the one product that came out. Let me find it here.
Okay.
Here we go. This is the one I kind of compare it to, because I mean, this is a Kickstarter that happened, and I'm like, really? It's called Revolutionaries: American War of Independence RPG. And when you read it, again, this is where it talks about where history truths hide a secret war. So there's like the again, this is a whole secret war going on with some sort of mystics.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess if you're maybe you don't like the colonial Gothic rule setting, you're like this rule setting, at least you could kind of, I don't know, intermingle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they're going to reach. They have 21 days left. They're looking for $13,000 US. They have about half that.
Well, it's doable. Just
it's,
you know,
doable.
You have to, yeah, you have to step up their presence to get that those last numbers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It uses this uses the Axion system. I've never. You guys familiar with that?
Nope.
Yeah.
I've heard it. Past, but I don't remember it per se.
Yeah, it uses the card-based engine. So it has a card-based engine when you... So basically, no dice. Is it no dice? No character sheet. Traditional character sheet in favor of hands of cards.
Okay.
So... I don't know. That's an interesting concept. Maybe as a one-shot game, but I'm not sure if I would run a long-term game that way. I don't know. I'd have to play it and see how it plays. I've just never
agreed.
I've never played the Axion system. I'd love to hear from a listener if they have and tell us actually how that plays out.
So, yep.
So there's that. That's kind of interesting. And then the big one for me is the Traveler. Traveler RPG, The Great Rift and Deep Space Exploration. Basically, it covers, I think it's in the Rim, the Soleimani, not the Soleimani Rim, but the Spinward Marches, the Rift that's between... Which is kind of cool, I think. You know, being able to, Third Imperium to Third Imperium. There's the Great Rift. Has a pretty good looking map. I mean, it's a standard map that you would see.
There's two of them.
Yeah, I thought most games took place in the Spinward March. Ultimately.
Yeah, but this one actually is the setting is actually the Rift.
Oh wow.
You know, so there's like if you look at the map, there's a huge empty space.
Yeah.
You know. And honestly, I've never understood how anyone really gets there unless you have a high jump ship anyway.
Dude, you get there, it's like 50 years later, even if you get there at full speed.
Well, I mean, because obviously in travel they use jump drives. So you really have to have a jump six ship to get at least within into the Rift. So, I mean, I guess there's a ship that possibly has enough fuel to jump multiple times. So, I mean, a lot of these planets are really out there.
Yeah, they're on the boonies, to put it mildly.
They've already reached their goal. They have 508 backers, and they have almost $57,000 in pledges.
Wow.
And they were only looking for right around $13,000 US. And so I think for the PDF, everything in the box set that they have in a PDF format is about $32 US. So...
There's a lot of stuff there, though, too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. I'm impressed. I just don't. It's not something I can back right now.
No, I understand.
I would love to. So to me, that's the big one for this week. I think for me is Traveler. So This is one that I don't know. Have you guys either? You guys played Dungeon Crawl Classics a lot?
I played it a little bit.
So you're going to be able to tell me the utility of these sheets. The scratch-off character sheets that Goodman Games is putting out.
I'm not sure anyone could explain the utility of those.
Yeah.
I think it's basically a cheap-ass way. Okay, I need a character. Here's a funnel. Let me grab them, scratch these characters off for the novelty. And I got my characters ready, and if I need more, I got more. It seems like, I'll be honest with you, I think this feels like a money-making scheme.
Yeah. the way they describe it is, it's instead of rolling up 20 zero level characters, you now just hand them the sheet and you scratch off, and it's just like whatever the attributes are is what you get. So basically, yeah, they already have, like, you know, a bunch of pre-mades, and a pack of sheets is about $10.
Yep.
And well, apparently the number of sheets will be based on their stretch goal.
Okay.
So depending on, because let's see, well, they're at 11, they're over 11,000 right now. Okay. So at 11,000, I guess it depends on how many packs get ordered. Yeah, yep. So it's like,
okay,
I don't know how many backers do they have. They have,
let's divide it by 10, then we will know for sure.
Yeah,
they'll give us at least a ballpark figure. So they've sold 1,120.
Yeah, at least 10 sheets per shrink back pack for $10, so a buck a sheet.
Yeah, and you'll get about 13 sheets per pack. So
yeah,
it's cute. I don't know if I'd want it though. You know, don't play enough Dungeon Crawler graphics to actually use it, but it might be fun.
The only use for these is maybe a con.
Yeah. Or, yeah, definitely. It's gimmicky, but it, and you know, Dungeon Crawl Classics has that kind of gonzo feel, which this fits, I think, right in with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a gimmick. You look at it and you go, why in the world? And then the next time you go to a convention, someone's handing them out, and everybody's like, these are the coolest things ever.
Yeah.
So.
It'll be funny if we're going to a con.
Yeah. All right. So next up, we have I'm just going in no particular order. Ghost Ops, an RPG of modern day covert operations, and this is interesting because there are two different rule sets. They have one for Savage Worlds that they're doing, and then they have another one that uses the Fate dice or the Fudge dice, but it's not Fate.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that works. You know, it'd be interesting to see which, I mean, I didn't actually read in here. Do they ask you to choose which rule book, or do you, they send two?
Yeah, you choose.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you look at, like, the Urban Assault level, it says you choose the, you receive a softback copy of the game in the version you choose. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's one of those things where, this is one of those ones that would be interesting to have both versions and just see how they compare.
Yep.
So, I have a feeling I would probably enjoy the Savage World version more.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they made their goal, so they're going to make it. So
yeah, it's kind of interesting. Although, I don't know. This is one of those games that I don't know if I would even use Savage Worlds for, because Savage Worlds has always been a more pulpy style game.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this fits very well for what they're trying to do. It'd be interesting to see, though.
Yeah.
And it's like, I love Savage Worlds, but it's like, you wonder, it's like, well, would you really want to run a straight out, you know, like spy game with, because they have, obviously there is, I know the damn game because I have it, Agents of Oblivion, but that's a more pulpy, you know, spy game anyway, the way they have that set up.
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, you can easily play, you know, obviously like Men in Black or something like the X-Files with that game system, you know, with that book. And they almost encourage you to set up your own thing for it.
Well, and they made their money, so it's just a matter of whether you want it or not.
Yeah. But I think it's cool. I mean, I like it. I like the idea. So, yeah, PDF version, $13 US. That's not too bad if you just wanted to take a look and see what they had. Again, you know, I'm all about the PDFs. Even if you don't play the game, it's always good to have the PDF.
And again, like we say many times, support your creators so they'll create more.
Yep. All right, let's go to, well, I think I'm going to leave them. Let's hit both the miniatures that we have. We have the Winter Adventures, which is 9 28mm fantasy miniatures and winter clothing. This is, they're going to ship anywhere in the world. And For a single figure, it's about $4, and I think if you wanted all nine, it's about $31.
No, they're cute. I'll give them credit for that. Although you could definitely tell it could be best described as the parka people.
Yeah, well, it's winter.
Yep.
So, I mean, I like the idea of it, you know, because it's like, how often do you actually have miniatures that actually respect the fact that, this is a winterland, you know, like there are settings where it's pretty much winter all the time. Mm-hmm. You live in an area. So it's kind of nice to have those figures every once in a while. So that's kind of cool. And then the other one I want to bring up just because, well, you know me, I've played a lot of RPGs that are set in Vietnam, oddly. Yep. And so we have Specialized Artisan Service Presents the NAM in 28mm. And for those of you who don't know, the NAM was a comic book.
Yep.
Believe it or not. So they're producing some miniatures for basically a platoon of people, you know, both the U.S. and obviously the North Vietnamese Army. And for about $35 gives you one or the other. And I think if you want both, I'm guessing you probably have to double that. One squad is $35 for the U.S. So you'd be spending about $70 to have a squad of each.
Yep.
Yeah.
I like the idea of it. It's just, this is one of those ones where I'd almost just buy my Green Army men and use them.
Yeah, that's kind of my...
Sadly. I mean, I like the idea of these, but it's like, yeah, and I know Green Army men are not 28mm scale, but they're close enough. And you can still buy them. You can, you know, because most of the Green Army men, honestly, are kind of in that weird zone of they're like kind of quasi-Korea, quasi-Vietnam, quasi-after-Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you have...
And if you're worried about posability, just swap out your character when you have to kneel or something.
Yeah. So those are the two miniatures. I kind of like them both, but again, your miles may vary on your miniatures because we don't, you know, there are a lot of games now that, you know, who wants to have a lot of miniatures hanging around?
Yep.
Mm. So, all right. So we have we have three, four more. And let's just go through these. We have a Hellscapes, a post-apocalyptic survival in D&D 5th edition. So...
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, you know. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's... They describe it as settings, you know, the setting as something along the lines of Mad Max or The Postman, with obviously some mutants as possibilities. And it's... So... That's kind of interesting because, you know, Gamworld's a little more farther out there, so this is a little bit more on this side of the Gamworld spectrum.
Yeah, a little bit more realistic, a little bit more looking for food in all the wrong places.
Yeah. So they're asking, what is this, $20 for the, is this the PDF?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $20 for the PDF, which include, obviously, a core rule book, a player's guide, character sheet, and something they call the Gambit deck. I'm not sure what the Gambit deck is. I guess it's some sort of mechanism that they have for their game. So now this the title of this one is just fun. Red Shirts, a Starfinder adventure path. And I've never played Starfinder. Have you?
Is it out yet?
I
don't think it's out for Gen Con.
But so there's already a Kickstarter for a level 1-3 adventure, I guess the start of it. I think it doesn't.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
looks interesting.
Obviously, it doesn't take itself seriously.
No.
Yeah. Well, I kind of figured when one of the terms is Mission 1: The Terrible Tacos.
Yeah.
That might be worth picking up just for the lols value, but we'll see.
Yeah. So I like that. That's kind of cool.
Yep. And they made their money, so. I guess whether or not you want to have a silly little... It reminds me almost like a Roger Wilco adventure. The old Space Quest games. So
that's
curious. That is one of those touch points that I'm always curious about.
All right, so let's get up the last three and get the hell out of here. We have, I've never, I don't remember the New Paths Compendium, a Pathfinder RPG expanded edition. Just basically covers a whole bunch of new classes, feat that you can have for Pathfinder. This is again one of those ones that there may be some interesting stuff in here, but you always wonder, do I really need this? And
Well,
I
and
don't.
somebody's buying it, obviously. They've already hit a couple of their stretch goals,
Yeah,
so.
no, I mean it's, but that's the way I always feel with a lot of these things. It's like, do I really need this supplement? You know, obviously for $15 and a PDF, that's not too bad. And at the very least, it's just some sort of reading. And I guess they have some interesting things. You know, so. And like you said, they've reached their goal and they've reached their some of their stretch goals. So, I mean, I guess if you play a lot of Pathfinder, then probably this will be interesting for you. All right, last two. First one up is the Midderlands and OSR mini setting and bestiary. I like little mini settings, so that's kind of cool. And it's like $10 for the PDF.
That's not bad at all.
No. So that I like. You know, I like that idea. And they got 20 days to go. They're only about halfway through their goal, so hopefully they reach it. That would be kind of cool if they do. And finally, we have the Mayhem role-playing game, which is, I don't know, it describes itself as designed for spectacular action, fast tactical combat, and creative character design. I'm not sure exactly what that means, really. You know, obviously it's another fantasy game based on the pictures.
I don't think they get they're 21 days ago. They only made 3,176
Yeah,
of
they're,
34.
oh my goodness, $35,000. That's a little much. That's my major problem with some of these. It's like, you know, I understand where you guys are coming from, but maybe you're asking for too much.
Well, a question that I'm having these guys is, what else have they produced? At this point, if they're asking for that much, like, I don't recognize the names. They might do good work. I just don't know them.
Yeah. It says that they have actually done three, they've created three Kickstarters. So the other one of which got canceled. And the other one is still going too. So that does not to me that does not bode well. Or did this? Oh no, this one actually went. They had a game called Goblins Eat Breakfast, which was just a card game.
Well,
Or not Goblins Eat Breakfast, Goblins Breakfast. Jeez. So,
did you guys talk about the new Top Secret
yes,
Kickstarter last time?
last week.
Yeah, we did.
You know, I thought I remembered you. I listened to a couple different podcasts, so I wasn't sure if it was on last episode, but yeah, that one's doing pretty well too.
No, and you know, it has the man who created the first one, so you can't complain about that. All right. Any final comments before we get the hell out of here?
Well, I guess the basic ones are, if you have any ideas about Cyberpunk that we didn't bring up on the show or anything you want to talk about the desert environments, let us know. Otherwise, we'll do, I think we're doing the big anything next week.
Next time, probably. I think that makes sense because it'll be just right the right time. All right. And with that, you can always send us any information you want to send us by info@rpgcircus.com. Go to our Facebook page, post something there. We have a link to the SpeakPipe application so you can actually record something and send that to us. Obviously, post something on our wall. If you go to our actual homepage, which the look has finally been redesigned, thank God, there is actually a link there to the SpeakPipe application as well. It says, you know, send voicemail, and you click the button, it brings up the little app and record away, and it sends it to us. So hopefully someone does that. And I think that's it. Anything else?
No, I think I'm good.
All right, then we will see everyone in about 2 weeks where we'll blab about the innies.
Sounds good.
Indeed.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.